Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Seema Khosla, the Medical Director of the North Dakota Center for Sleep. She shared her insight into the recent American Academy of Sleep Medicine's position statement and ongoing initiative to switch to a fixed standard time year-round from daylight saving time, as well as offered her perspective on the current state of sleep in the United States. So, without further ado, let's dive in.
Hey, my name is Seema Khosla. I am a sleep medicine physician. My background is pulmonary, critical care, and sleep. I am the medical director of the North Dakota Center for Sleep here in Fargo. Yeah, so this is something near and dear to the heart of the AASM. They actually released a position statement on this exact topic, and it was endorsed by more than 20 different groups, so medical groups and scientific groups and civic organizations. And the whole premise is, you know, we would like to eliminate daylight saving time. So both the switch, the twice yearly switch, but then we also feel that we should adhere to a permanent standard time, not permanent daylight time. And so it's been really very interesting. Actually, they had a hearing yesterday. So I'm very curious to see what the results of the hearing were with the Energy and Commerce Committees on the House side. But the idea of switching our time zones twice a year is extremely disruptive to our circadian rhythm. We know that that Monday after we have lost an hour, so in the springtime, there is a higher risk of motor vehicle collisions. There are more medical errors, more stroke. So these are predictable, and we've seen these year after year after year.
And it's always interesting to see when, you know, larger organizations, medical societies like this get involved in policy stuff. And I'm curious, you know, does that negative impact, obviously something that happens at least twice a year when we get this switch, but is it something that lingers? Is, you know, has there been literature that suggests that, you know, not only just that Monday after, but then, you know, in the weeks following, you know, how long does it take people to sort of readjust, I guess, when that switch happens?
You know, there's some data suggesting that we don't ever adjust. The more robust data shows us that certainly we have that impact, not just the Monday, but through that week and weeks. So it's more than just losing an hour of sleep, right? It's also that now all of a sudden we are misaligned with our circadian rhythm. And so that is disruptive on both ends. So it's hard when we're waking up, right? Because we are a little bit short on time. But the other thing that I think has been kind of fascinating about this whole thing is that, you know, we don't magically get an extra hour of daylight, right? Like the sun is in the sky for the same exact amount of time, no matter what the clock says. And yet in our heads, we kind of have married these two together. And so if we think this through, this also means that in the fall, it is dark in the morning, after 8 o'clock in the morning for a lot of the country. And so we've got kids hopping on school buses at 8 o'clock in the morning. And the flip side is, you know, I live in Minnesota and I work in North Dakota. And so for us, if we were to stay on daylight saving time, it would be light until almost 11 o'clock at night. So that's a really hard thing to do when you're trying to get your kids in the bed, right? When it's still bright and sunny outside.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, just the, it's interesting to think about the marrying of those two things, because you're right. You know, you do think, oh, we're losing some daylight, but in reality, the daylight is not changing despite the clocks being adjusted.
Right.
I wonder, you know, how common
is the knowledge? Obviously, I would imagine the clinical and physician communities is pretty aware of circadian rhythm and the importance of maintaining that sleep wake pattern without disrupting it. But how aware is the lay population of that science? Is that something that's been a struggle to educate them on? Because again, me thinking from that perspective, it is a very married thing because we've dealt with daylight saving for so long. How's the education part of that been on the patient side of things?
I've actually been really surprised at how many things are out there on social media. I think everybody can agree that the switch is bad. And so where it starts to become a little bit more nuanced and sort of more contentious is whether we stay with daylight saving permanently or we stick with permanent standard time. And so there are organizations that I've seen online that really have kind of taken this and they've started running with it. And they have been charged and tasked with improving education around this for the lay people.
And then on the science end of it, I mean, have you found, I imagine someone in your specialty, the majority of the clinical sleep community is pretty aware of this, but on their end, are there any tips, I guess, you could share in terms of educating patients about this, about why that, because, again, if this switch does happen, this switch to a fixed standard time, I imagine a lot of that patient community is going to be a little confused by that. And, how important is it to make sure that the physicians are able to kind of discuss the importance of, again, like that lack of disruption to the sleep-wake pattern?
I think part of it is that we can almost piggyback on some of the education that came when we tried to delay school start times. So I think that's been pretty widely accepted now that even the American Academy of Pediatrics really emphasizes that schools for middle school and high school should not start any earlier than 8:30 in the morning. And so if you think about it, if we have already adopted this and we've embraced this, right? Like in California, we're like, yes, this is great. We know the kids do better and they have less impulsive behavior and they're less cranky. And this is a good thing, right? If we adopt permanent daylight time, we lose all of that. Yeah. And so the theory behind delaying school start times is that in adolescence, kids start to stay up a little bit later, right? They stay up later, they sleep in, and this isn't being lazy. This is normal. This is normal physiology for adolescents. And so when we ask them to wake up earlier, we sacrifice usually that last really good section of REM sleep that they should be getting in those early morning hours. And so we've really understood that importance of maintaining their circadian rhythm and being respectful of when they are naturally programmed to fall asleep and to wake up. And so I'm hoping that we can piggyback on that and really expand that type of education to other people. Most people have embraced delayed school start times. Obviously, sometimes there's pushback from coaches or parents that need to drop their kid off or something like that. But by and large, I think people have accepted that. And so I'm hoping likewise, they will see those parallels between delaying school start time and maintaining permanent standard time. It's just more in sync with our own internal clock.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've been having a ton of conversations just over the past, year or two. And it's really interesting to hear how, obviously I think everyone at a baseline understands that sleep is important to our health, but even considering, ASM's position statement last summer about this, just really kind of hammering home how much we've learned in the last couple decades about just how essential sleep is to things like that, that even, getting to that conversation about delayed school time, about how so much of society seems to function not in accordance with how our bodies do, need them to function, and particularly for kids who are, and growing bodies, is, what's the sort of state of clinical evidence, I guess, so to say, for something like this approach, like this fixed standard time? Is there anything out there, countries across the world or perhaps on a state level, if other states have addressed it, is there any sort of evidence that backs that, look, this could be potentially incredibly beneficial for just people's, not even just how people function on a day-to-day basis, but on the pediatric side of things, kids' ability to to function normally and grow the way they should.
Yeah, you know, it's actually, it's really kind of interesting. Mayo did a study, you know, maybe a few years ago. And if you remember, Mayo has sites in Florida and in Minnesota, but also in Arizona. And so in Arizona, right, they don't switch their time seasonally. And they compared medical errors, and they found fewer medical errors when you don't have to switch time. So I think that is really telling. You know, I'm very encouraged that even, you know, politicians have started thinking about this, even though we would love to think that this is just a sleep and circadian rhythm problem or issue. There's a lot of politics involved in this. So when daylight saving time, you know, have you ever noticed that we don't switch back until after Halloween? That was, yeah, that was like candy. Like the candy companies were lobbying because they want the kids to stay up an hour later, right? So that they sell more candy. So there's a lot of these other political things that we need to consider. You know, the part about kids getting up that we were talking about earlier, when it's still dark, right, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they're hopping on school buses. I mean, that poses a safety issue. Yeah. And I think when people kind of recognize that and understand that, I think it all of a sudden it crystallizes, right? In 1974, they tried permanent daylight time, and it was very, very popular at the beginning, but they had to end it early because I think people realized that, oh, wait, we don't actually get this extra magic hour of sunlight, right? They realized how dark it was in the fall, and they abandoned it before even a year was done.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Kosla to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, Roche has announced that it will be conducting a new phase 3 clinical trial called Skyline, which will evaluate its subcutaneous investigational anti-amyloid antibody, gantenerumab, as a preventive treatment for patients with early signs of Alzheimer's disease. The trial will include an estimated 1,200 participants aged 60 to 80 years old who have amyloid positivity confirmed by CSF or PET, but lack signs of cognitive impairment. Its primary endpoint will be the change from baseline to year 4 in the composite PAC-5 score, and Roche intends to present the Skyline trial design next week at the 2022 International Conference on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's Disease, or ADPD, in Barcelona, Spain. Next, the FDA approved the Evoke spinal cord stimulation system from Saluda Medical for the treatment of chronic intractable pain of the trunk and/or limbs, including unilateral or bilateral pain associated with failed back surgery syndrome, intractable low back pain, and leg pain. The company noted it plans to implement a controlled limited release of the system in the second half of 2022 among selected sites, prior to its full commercial release next year in 2023. The system is designed to maintain optimal pain inhibition by adjustments, which it does more than 100 times per second. And the Evoke system also captures and records millions of data points per day in order to help guide clinical teams and keep them informed on the performance of the system. With its approval, it becomes the first and only SCS system capable of instantaneously reading, recording, and responding to Evoke compound action potentials in order to provide a more optimized performance. Finally, the FDA has authorized an investigational new drug application for the initiation of a phase 2b clinical trial of the mGluR5 inhibitor NOE-101 in trigeminal neuralgia. Its developer, Noema Pharma, has announced. The study will evaluate the efficacy of the treatment for pain management associated with trigeminal neuralgia. Dubbed Libra-TN, the multicenter 24-week prospective double-blind randomized withdrawal placebo-controlled trial is further evaluating NOE-101, which was found to be safe and well-tolerated in a prior study of adult subjects with TN. Data from this new trial are anticipated to be reported in the first half of 2024, and in Q1, the company announced that it had begun dosing. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Kosla.
Again, you know, it's just interesting that, to see this sort of push from the ASM in the last couple of years at really trying to address some of these issues. So I guess speaking to sort of the state of sleep more broadly, I mean, how would you describe, you know, at least to your knowledge, based on the conversations that you've had with patients and just sort of with your peers and the community as a whole, but how would you describe the state of sleep in the United States? I know that's a very, you know, wide encompassing question, but again, you know, because there has been just so much understanding gained in the past couple decades. And it just seems like now we're really trying to hammer home the importance of this stuff. But, you know, it's the same thing when you hear from the doctor, when you go into a visit, you know, hey, make sure you eat healthy and you exercise. These are the type of, you know, behavioral and lifestyle changes that people can make that can drastically improve their health. But I don't know how often people are following those. Do you think most people are getting good sleep and understand that, you know, the importance of it?
You know what I've really, really loved? I love how people are evangelizing about sleep, like on Instagram. So it's not this, I'm going to stay up late and party. It's this, hey, look at this cool sleep mask that I have. And hey, this is my sleep environment and look how serene it is. And I painted my walls lavender or whatever, right? And so there's this push where all of a sudden now people are embracing sleep. You know, when I was an intern, it was such a badge of honor to stay up late. And I will never forget my first night after being on call, like my very first, you know, time as an intern, I fell asleep at a stop sign on my way home and somebody had to, you know, beep their horn at me. And I remember my first feeling was, I am such a good little intern. I fell asleep at a stop sign. it was such a point of pride for me. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to realize how harmful that was. So I'm really impressed that, you know, people are being more thoughtful about their sleep. So of course we have this momentum, right? Where people understand that sleep is this important pillar of health, right? Along with diet and exercise. And then you throw in this pandemic and we have all this stress, right? And then all of a sudden we have all this remote work and it kind of divvied up our population into the frontline workers and then these sort of Zoom neighborhoods, right, where people could work remotely. And what was really interesting is we saw a lot of insomnia and that sort of thing with, you know, frontline workers. They were anxious and they had all these concerns. But then we also had this group of people that were able to sleep in and catch up on their sleep and to understand their circadian rhythm, right? Because maybe they're not morning people. And so by working remotely, they could wake up when they wanted to and work when they wanted to, and they increase their productivity. So I love how you phrase this as sort of like the state of the union of sleep, right, in the US. And I'd love to paint it all with this big, broad brushstroke. But, you know, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, this hasn't impacted us all in the same way, right? You know, we're all in the same storm, but we've all been on different ships.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's an interesting point, you know, even just that, you know, thinking about this, obviously, this push specifically really has the, you know, the general population, the overall US population in mind. But to your point earlier about your time as an intern, you know, that it is a very interesting kind of juxtaposition to think about someone, you know, who's going through the training process to become a, you know, down the road, a sleep focused physician who's sacrificing vital hours of sleep, getting through that portion of their career. And I know that's, you know, that's a challenge for med students and fellows and sort of younger people coming into the field across the board, you know, so it's interesting as well to see the potential ramifications on that end, you know, the fact that the people who are the most aware of how important sleep is on a, you know, hard science and medicine level are also part of experience, you know, are dealing with that sort of part of the problem, that lack of sleep.
But you've hit on something really important though. You know, there's the assumption that med students and residents know all about sleep. And the reality is that on average, we get like an hour, maybe 2 hours through medical school and residency. So when I was an intern, I had no idea that sleep was even a field.
No, you're correct. I mean, that is true as well. So, and I guess that points to another, you know, we've talked a little bit about the lay population's, you know, education about the importance of sleep. But to that point that you just made, you know, how would you, I guess, describe the state of sleep education among physicians as a whole? Obviously, again, the people in the pulmonology and neurology fields are kind of, you know, I would assume are the ones with perhaps who touch it the most. But outside of that, you know, do you think that there is widespread understanding of that science? And what do we do to address the fact that it just isn't a major focus when it comes to training?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, it's certainly better than it was, but it's nowhere near where it needs to be. Yeah. You know, even the idea that so many people fall into our field after they've completed a fellowship or they've done something else, and then they kind of stumble upon sleep and they're like, oh, I didn't know that this was even a thing that you could do. You know, and so if you don't know, you don't know, right? And so you're so just busy as a med student and as a resident and a fellow. And, you know, it's hard to come up for air. And so now there are these different fellowship pathway programs that kind of, I think, accept that people are not going to just come straight out of like internal medicine residency, for example. There's a one-year program you can do, but there's also hybrid programs with pulmonary and critical care. And there are programs that kind of let you do it sort of at your own, like almost part-time, which is kind of cool because I think it really kind of respects the idea that, you know, we can't just hide out in school forever, right? That we have other obligations and families and, you know, children and that sort of thing. But I do think that we need to do better in terms of providing more sleep education wherever we can. And so we're trying to do it on different levels. So for example, this last week, we've been looking at videos from the ASM has this yearly high school sleep video contest, which is super cool. So these high school students submit these videos and it's about some sort of sleep related thing, and then they can win money. And so I think the way that we need to kind of tackle this elephant, if you will, is a little at a time, right? Introduce the importance of sleep early, introduce it through medical training, and make it just as acceptable to talk about, right? As diet and exercise, and not have it be this taboo thing that no one ever talks about.
Yeah, I definitely think that is a very interesting and important point, because, and I agree with, you know, with your point earlier about sort of the pandemic's impact on this. I think it has gotten a little crazy, and I think people have perhaps deprioritized it either out of necessity or because of sort of the situations they've been forced into with, you know, remote work, perhaps extending the hours that now you're available to do work or, you know, be in school, whatever it may be. So I guess to shift the conversation a little bit, one of the last things I wanted to ask you is just, you know, because I think it kind of ties into a lot of what we're talking about, is how important are, you know, this upcoming week we have National Sleep Awareness Week, and it culminates in World Sleep Day on the 18th. So how important are those, you know, from your perspective, those types of awareness campaigns in raising, again, that awareness to these issues and really making both the public and the clinical community aware of, you know, hey, we understand this is important, but there are still a lot of things that need to be addressed and a lot of challenges to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, these types of public awareness campaigns are extremely important. And yes, you know, the World Sleep Congress is going on this week, and World Sleep Day. It's at least a day to raise awareness of that, you know, the idea, like you said, the importance of sleep. Sleep is essential to health. Ideally, I would love to have more conversations around this. You know, I think when we go to our doctor, our primary care doc, we talk about, you know, height and weight and, you know, diabetes and that sort of thing. And when somebody has a sleep issue, it's often that last minute sort of hand on the door type of question. Hey, by the way, I can't sleep. Right. And it's so funny because I think for people who don't really play in this area or who don't understand this, the answer is not always a prescription, right? A lot of our trouble sleeping can stem from, you know, childhood trauma or just, you know, bad sleep hygiene or a medication side effect or some supplement that somebody is taking, you know, or even mistimed light. And so the idea of at least initiating that conversation in primary care or wherever, and if it is something that's a little bit more in depth, then yes, please refer to your, you know, friendly neighborhood sleep doc, because we would be happy to help with that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think you pointed to a very key part of that. Obviously, you know, I think in an ideal world, we'd be able to get everyone with those challenges in front of a sleep specialist. But, you know, speaking to those primary care doctors, or the, you know, even the general neurologists out there, say, or the pulmonologists who are just seeing patients for other reasons where this conversation, type of conversation might come up. The last thing I want to ask you is just, are there any tips or bits of advice that you feel you might be able to share with the clinical community in terms of how to broach that topic, or at least how to make it a priority for patients, so it's not, like you're saying, that sort of as the door is closing type of conversation?
So I have to say that one thing that came out of the pandemic that we became a little bit more thoughtful of was how to collaborate with our primary care docs. You know, I think we all witnessed as a whole that those usual preventative care visits just stopped, right? Mm-hmm. And visits were very, you know, problem focused. And so what we tried to do is incorporate just a question about sleep. How is your sleep? Are you satisfied with your sleep? You know, something about, you know, do you snore? Some just very basic thing. And I guess I have an advantage. My mom is a family practice doc and my brother's an endocrinologist. And so I get to pick their brains a lot about, you know, what is tenable, what is something that, you know, you can incorporate into your clinic visit. And sometimes just a question of how's your sleep, you know, is enough of an opening where somebody will say, you know what, actually, I'm not sleeping well. Or, hey, you know what, my husband says I'm snoring, or something like that. It at least is an opening for our patients. Just please, you know, remember that, you know, we have to consider sleep as maybe not the end of our day. And I'm going to steal this from a colleague of mine, but it is the beginning of our next day. So be thoughtful about how we want to plan for that. Make sure that we allocate enough hours for sleep. We're respectful of our sleep environment. We create a sleep routine and make sure that when we are short on time, the thing that we should be cutting is probably our, you know, our sort of TikTok watching time and not our sleep time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.